Hi, I'm Sylvie Simmons. I'm the author of I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen, and I'm here talking to Dave Lefkowitz on UNC on his lovely program called Dave Gone By.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Saturday morning. One of my favorite musicians in the world. Well, of course, Bob Dylan is up there, number one, sure. And there's a couple of others, but somewhere in that top 10 is Leonard Cohen, because he's made terrific music for decades now, from that very first almost fully acoustic album to his more, oh, I don't even know what to call it, Parisian cocktail music, end of the world style that has marked his last couple of albums and everything in between. He's an extraordinary musical figure, and he deserved a really comprehensive, extraordinary biography. And he's gotten one, probably. Certainly the most comprehensive, probably the best biography of Leonard Cohen out there was written just a couple of years ago by Sylvie Simmons, an English writer. It's called I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen, and the author has also done books about Neil Young and Serge Gainsbourg, and she's interviewed tons of rock stars for various magazines. So it's exciting for me to talk with Sylvie Simmons here on Dave's Gone By. Good morning, Sylvie.
Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? You said off the air that your voice is a little... Do you have a cold or something, or just morning voice?
Well, I'm trying to sort of get towards my Nico voice, so it's getting dustier and lower, but we'll see by the end of it. It might be fully Germanic. Let's hope not.
I would love to hear your Nico voices. Hello, Dave. It's good to talk to you.
That actually sounded more like Lars of Metallica, but it was a good try.
Is that really how Lars Ulrich talks?
Kind of, but a little faster.
Well, you know what?
It sounded very Danish.
Well, I had a crawler this morning, so that's close to a Danish. That was a terrible joke, but you know what?
That was so bad, I didn't even acknowledge it. My brain just swatted it out. Sorry.
Well, this is going to be a fun interview. But you know, before we get to Leonard Cohen, since you mentioned Lars Ulrich, and you, I guess, interviewed him or all the members of Metallica, any memories of them?
Well, I kind of knew Lars before he was in Metallica, when he thrust a little cassette tape in my hands of something that he'd recorded in his garage and told me this was his new band, at that point unnamed, which became Metallica. And I heard it, and it sort of just didn't really sound like much of anything. So I'm kind of like the man who passed on the Beatles, I guess. I said, you'll never get anywhere, dear, but it's nice to know you. And, of course, now he's a megastar. But, you know, every now and then I'd come across a band that I heard and thought, this is going to be a big band like Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue. So there were a few that I managed to get right. But Lars, I think, has forgiven me for that.
This would have been many years ago. Why would he have specifically given you a tape? Who were you writing for at that time? And what power did you have?
Ah, my power. It was an amazing time. It was in the late 70s. I started writing in 77 when I was 2.5 years old. I have to say this now. Otherwise, it would be terrible on the dating sites. But I started in 77. I started as an LA correspondent for a British weekly called Sounds magazine. There were three of them. There was Melody Maker, Enemy, and Sounds. And Enemy was so anti-American stuff at the time, this being the punk era, they didn't want a correspondent. And Melody Maker already had a good one, so I became Sounds' correspondent. And while I was living in LA is when the big kind of metal scene started happening. You know, they decided the second I arrived, I think that Elvis Presley died and heavy metal was kind of born American style. And so I was there when there were all of these bands going on. So I was kind of, I guess, quite known in that circle.
But it's a little odd, since you're writing about people like Leonard Cohen, a big book about him, and Serge Gainsbourg, it would sound like heavy metal would not be the kind of music that you would remotely care about. Was it just a job for you, or did you like some of that music?
You know, I think what happens with music journalists is you become kind of eclectic, because it's almost like you're in a sort of chocolate factory, and there's this constant stream of goodies going by, and you've got your favorites, of course. And when I was young, I really loved Leonard Cohen. I loved him from the day I hit puberty, which was the day that I heard his music on a compilation album. Too young to afford to buy an album, but I heard him from then. And so I loved the Beatles, I loved Leonard Cohen, I loved Bob Dylan, maybe a little less Dylan because he sounded so kind of nasally and weird. And Leonard sounded sexy even when I was a kid. And you just find all these new things that come along on this sort of wonderful factory conveyor belt that are just given to me for free as a music journalist, you know.
That's true. Back then, that was a big deal. I mean, you got free records and albums, and because now anybody can pay $9 a month and get 4 million songs of everything at once. It used to be a big deal that you get free music, you know?
It did. It really got you some friends as well, let me tell you. Free tickets to all of the shows you ever wanted to go to, and flights here, there, and everywhere. Even free clothes, as long as you didn't mind wearing a kind of silk, you know, satiny kind of silk journey jacket and a kind of pair of Ronnie James Dio sweatpants or something. You know, I usually drew the line at those. But, you know, it was a very interesting time, and it was a time before MTV. Once MTV came along and really started catching on in the early 80s, it kind of started a kind of glossification of rock, and those weekly papers that I wrote for, like Sounds in England, or even Cream magazine, the legendary magazine in America that I wrote for, which had a glossy cover but kind of newspapery middle,
right.
Those sort of started falling by the wayside as everybody wanted this kind of visual element to their music, and plus it was more democratized. You know, the few of us who were music journalists as lifers, if you like, as full-timers, really we had to share our space because things weren't just written about in rock magazines anymore. They were written about in newspapers, and they were all over the TV.
Good point. And can I ask, since you got to see concert after concert, do you have one or two great memories of the best concerts you ever saw, or some of the scariest or wildest things that occurred?
Well, the wildest ones are the ones that I can't remember, thankfully, because, you know, back then there were all sorts of substances handed out to journalists
really?
That the bands had, and so there were times when you were just mostly sort of slumped in a corner. You know, it was amazing because you were so young, it didn't matter, you still look cute. If I did it now, they would probably take me to a homeless shelter, but you know, back then it was a different time.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, I mean, I saw some absolutely mind-blowing concerts. I mean, the ones that stick in your mind are things like Pink Floyd's The Wall or something, you know, even though that album has never reached even my top 100 of favourite albums. So I get a bit kind of tingly when they play Comfortably Numb every now and then.
Which was just kind of
you
ironic.
The kind of big spectaculars that you get, but mostly it's the behind-the-scenes stuff. If anybody ever saw the film Almost Famous, that's kind of what my life was like. You know, you'd end up going to a festival in a helicopter with one of the bands, and they're sitting there with a magazine on their lap with a photograph of their face, you know, and on the nostrils they're piling sort of white substance on the nostrils of their pictures. It's so decadent, you know.
Well, actually, let me ask.
French literature, you know. And
a few months ago, or maybe it was a year or two ago, I interviewed Carol Miller, who is a radio host here, or was in New York, I should say, for many, many years. And she was in that situation as a DJ on a major New York radio station. And she was able to hang out and interview and meet all these famous rock stars. She actually was involved in a relationship, I forget, with one who was like on major, major drugs at the time. She thought he was dead at one point. I'm forgetting who it was. But did you have any liaisons with people of fame?
Liaisons. Well, you know, the thing was that when I started, I was such a sweet little innocent thing, and I kind of, you know, like the female version of you know, Cameron Crowe in a way. I just loved the music, and I think just to see if I would survive, you know, like the old system of putting babies on mountainsides or explosions or something. One of the first assignments I had was being sent on a tour bus with Black Sabbath.
Oh, God.
It was wonderful. We did this tour, and my eyes are lighting up as I think of it. And they were so adorable to me. It was like I was their little sister. They looked after me.
Oh.
They threatened the roadies with castration if they went anywhere near me. And I survived that. It was the last tour that Sabbath did before they broke up. I know they're back together now. And their opening act was Van Halen, so I got to be very friendly with Dave Lee Roth. But, you know, after a while, when you go on the road with bands, and I did that a lot, what they would call embedded, if you were a war journalist, but but not embedded in
not
way,
embedded.
I kind of realized that there aren't that many women journalists, and usually they, you know, the men will offer, but, you know, you kind of learn to say no pretty fast, because you've seen where they've been and what they've been doing when they were there, so, you know, out of self-interest, you kind of prefer to go out with behind-the-scenes people rather than the actual bands.
Oh, interesting. So no.
But I would never kiss and tell.
Oh, well, if you were, is there someone that you're not mentioning that, you know, I hear that giggle. Come on, give us a hint.
It's always better to be a mystery. It's one of the reasons that I love Leonard Cohen so much, is that he's a bit of a mystery, you know? He doesn't give the game away. The only time that he ever revealed anything about a woman that he'd had a liaison with, other than when their names are mentioned in the title, like Suzanne or Marianne, you know, the ones who were around for a while, was on Chelsea Hotel number 2, where he had accidentally let slip that the woman who was giving him head in an unmade bed in the Chelsea Hotel, the actual lyrics that he said, was Janis Joplin. And he said he really, really felt bad about that, never again kissed and told. And he said, in a way, it's okay, he said it actually upset his mom. So ungentlemanly.
But actually, the thing about that song, Chelsea Hotel Number 2, is it probably upset his mom because there's a reference to him getting oral sex from Janis Joplin.
No, but
the song itself is nasty.
He actually gave the game away and named. She said it was very ungentlemanly.
Yeah. But I think also is ungentlemanly because it's unlike a lot of his poetic things about, you know, how wonderful women are, how sacred and how beautiful they are. You know, that song closes with a line of like, well, you know, that's all. I don't think of you that often. I mean, it's a nasty little number.
It is, considering how pretty the melody is. There's a lot of cruelty. I noticed that later in a lot of his work, too, that, you know, he could be very, very cruel to women. There was a very strange thing I found out. With this book, it came out a year ago, actually, and I'd spent years, I mean, completely working on this, but one of the things that I'd found in the archives actually of Columbia Record Studios,
yeah.
Big at Hay, you know, back in those days, if you were signed to Columbia, you did stuff in their studios. It was a bit like the old film system, you know, you did everything within their in-house. I found those sort of recording cards, which were just a bunch of kind of like postcardy things written on, you know, those old-fashioned cards that they used to file before digital came in, to say who was in the studio and what they were working on, which was wonderful because there's no credits on albums
right
then. And there was this one song that he was recording over and over again on the very tortured first album. I realized from these cards how hard it was for him to make this album. But there was a song called Come On Marianne. And at first I thought it was a typo, but I kept coming across it. And by the end of the album, it turned into So Long Marianne. And so I called up Marianne Ilhan, the Norwegian model who was his girlfriend for 7 years, who he lived with on the Greek island of Hedra for most of the time, mm-hmm. where he had a little tiny house. And I asked her, and she had a very sad voice, and she said, well, it kind of was meant to be, come on, Marianne, let's just keep this ship afloat. And I guess by the end of the song, it wasn't. It was goodbye. And
oh, wow.
As Leonard himself said, some people tend to write hello kind of songs. And some people write goodbye kind of thing. So he says it in a Leonard Cohen way, which is valedictory. Some people are more drawn to the valedictory.
Well, the thing about him is, and he's had this all throughout his life and through your book, is this weird thing of his seeming like this Galahad kind of gentleman, but at the same time being a bit of a selfish egotist, certainly when it came to women, and expecting to, you know, have a woman at home and every other woman that he wants when he wants them, which I imagine did not sit well with Marianne or some of his other women, you know?
What's surprising is that I did speak to a great deal of the important women in his life, a great many, I should say, of the important women in his life. It's something that biographers don't tend to do, you know, but more my interest was less what was going on behind the bedroom door than in really the importance that women had in his life and work, because his early poetry was the same. It was written to women. He had women as muses. And when he started in the music business, he had a woman manager. He had Judy Collins, for heaven's sake, you know. The great folk singer at that time was a huge star, covering his songs before he even had an album deal. So he had a lot of support from women. He adored women. His father died when he was 9, so he was raised in a house of women. His mother, Masha, who adored him, and his older sister, Esther, who still adores him, is still alive in her 80s and goes to his shows, and anything to do with him is a bit of a cheerleader. But he also had this need to, he needed women, but he also needed to get away from women. So it wasn't something that he seemed to do in any kind of sense of ruthlessness, and I'm not trying to sort of sugar the pill here, but generally from what the women have said to me, he did his best. He never lied. He never said he would be faithful. He tried. And it seems to be that he just needed women, but as soon as he had them, he needed to get away from him. And his most exquisite poetry and lyrics were written from a state of longing in that state of emptiness, needing to be filled. You can see why he was drawn to Buddhism, can't you?
And also, you do mention that poetry came first, obviously, before the idea of his even being a songwriter and putting things to guitar and creating songs out of them. Do you think, had he not become a music star, do you think his poetry would have lasted? He certainly wouldn't be as famous as he is, but do you think he would be known still in poetry circles or beyond poetry circles, or not even?
I think he would be known in poetry circles. To him, it's really strange. I mean, for him, it's almost like a synesthesia. There isn't that much difference for him between poetry and song. He said an interesting thing. It was when he was 15 years old, which I kind of figure is almost like the big bang of Leonard, was that he had happened upon the poetry of Lorca, you know, Federico Garcia Lorca. Mm-hmm. He just came across a book outside in a, you know, one of those used bookshops and was looking at it. And he said when he started reading Lorca's poetry, he said he heard the music of the synagogue, like the hair stood up on his arm. Now, that sounds like a kind of very typical grand kind of Leonard Cohen anecdote. But, you know, I asked a follow-up question, you know, why the music of the synagogue? Because, as we know, his, you know, religion and love and everything become very intermingled, almost inextricably so in his work. And he said, well, mostly because that was the music that he really knew. You know, he knew the music of the synagogue. There wasn't much music around the house at home. And it was an era when music wasn't as prevalent as it now is now. Leonard is 79. He was born in 1934. So you're thinking, like, when he was a teenager, I can't do sums, 34 plus 15, 40, something like somewhere about 48 or something. You know, it was an era before rock and roll music, you know. There wasn't anything. You wouldn't turn on a radio and hear a rock band. And so there was this kind of strange musical element to things for him. And as I was digging through his archives, I would find that some of the writing that he didn't publish had sort of like these experiments in music in them almost, like he was almost setting them as a musical thing. Huh. And that same year that he was 15, he got his first guitar. Turned out that I found out, you know, I'd outed him as a ukulele player. He'd been playing uke for a while beforehand, but just like little kids did. But he started learning the guitar properly after that. And so he often took his guitar along to poetry readings and things when he was doing those. So there was always that element of music there. Oh, one thing that I did want to point out is when I went to Montreal, where Leonard was born, one of the places I went to was the synagogue that his ancestors had founded, and his old rabbi was still alive, who had taught his bar mitzvah class. And so I asked him, you know, did Leonard sing in the synagogue? And he gave me the most curious look through his eyebrows and said, Leonard sing? So Leonard didn't have the kind of voice that was made for a rock star. So he never really thought about being a rock star. A poet was what he was, and in a way still is.
Well, yeah, it's funny, since you mention the synagogue and the cantorial music and things like that, I thought it would be a good time to bring in a very good friend of this radio program, Rabbi Sol Solomon, who is, of course, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And the rabbi has some rather specifically Jewish questions about Leonard Cohen, and some other questions as well. If you don't mind, I would love to bring the rabbi in.
Excellent. I'll do my best to bluff the answers.
Oh, wonderful. Rabbi, yeah. Come talk to Sylvie Simmons. She's on the phone with us. Oh, wonderful. Shalom? Hello?
Is this Shalom, Sylvie? How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. I don't have a rock star voice either, but I fake it.
I like that. I like men who fake it.
I'm a true... really? I generally tend to not like women who fake it, but I appreciate the effort. Anywho, we're talking with Sylvie Simmons. She is the author of the book I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen. Most important question, Sylvie Simmons, are you Jewish?
You know, I'm a quarter Jewish, so I already said a quarter shalom to you. My grandfather, who I didn't know because he died in the First World War, you know, I was not around then, even though I'm quite venerable and ancient for a rock journalist. But I can tell you one thing. I found out through a genealogist that I have an ancestor who was one of the best-known Jewish bare-knuckle boxers in England and invented the uppercut. What I can say is, watch yourself.
Wow. Oh, I will be on my best behavior, which is still pretty horrible, but it's better than my worst behavior. I'll give you that. We're talking about Leonard Cohen, though, your book about Leonard Cohen, and he came from a history of rabbis in his family, didn't he, or something like that?
Yeah, they go back for generations. It's amazing. He even had a great uncle who was rabbi of Montreal, you know?
You were telling Dave that religion and music are intermingled in a way. In your talking with Leonard Cohen, did he explain why or how?
Well, as he kind of said about Judaism, he said that, same with his dad, that they never talked about it. It's like a fish wouldn't talk about water. You know, I'm a Jew, I'm a Jew, I'm a Jew. It was always there. And his family was of a very high status amongst the Jews. They were wealthy Jews, well-off or prosperous Jews. They owned, you know, rather kind of good companies there. They'd founded synagogues and newspapers, Jewish newspapers. So, you know, his family had a great deal of status, I found out from his childhood friends who knew him then. And so he really just, it was a given. He didn't do a Dylan and try and reinvent himself. He didn't pretend he was born on the right side of the tracks, and or the wrong side of the tracks, rather. He was born on the right side of the tracks. Excuse me, getting that sense of direction.
No problem.
There. But, you know, he never really thought about it, never changed his name from being Cohen. And even with all of his various studies of other spiritual practices and becoming a Buddhist monk, for heaven's sake, over the years, he always came back and said, I'm a Jew.
Well, that's the key thing I was going to ask, is if Judaism was so important and huge for him, why the hell, not only will he be a monk, because Buddhism is more a journey than a religion, per se, but he also went through Scientology, which is as lunatic a thing as I can possibly imagine. Was he cleared in level 4 or something nonsense like that?
Well, you know, when I asked him in the past about, you know, the Scientology, he was very kind of shtum about it, and I asked him if he went clear, and it was a very ambiguous answer, but I found a certificate in his archives. He very kindly trusted me on this and gave me access to everything, and so, yes, I found a certificate that he is an operating thetan. But, you know, if you put this in context, because I had the same sort of shock in me, like, for God's sake, Scientology, what were you thinking, man, you know? He said that they had very good data. And what he meant by that was when he was doing this, which was like 68, 69, it was almost like a kind of, you know, a precursor of the self-help groups, you know, those DIY books on, you know, make yourself happier, how to, I don't really read those things, I kind of tend to
read. I read one that's called the Torah, goddammit. Well, anyway.
But there is, but you know, if you're born to that and it hasn't worked, the old orthodoxies weren't working, I think a self-help group was what he was looking for. He wasn't looking for a new God. I mean, certainly L. Ron Hubbard is, you know, not somebody who's likely to follow to the ends of the earth or, you know, be ordained in. But he left fairly soon afterwards, and it was a time in his life when he was extremely troubled. He had extremely, extremely deep depression. As he said, it wasn't the blues. I would wake up every morning thinking, what do I do to get through this day? You know, what combination of drugs, drink, women, work, whatever can get me through this day? And it was a troubling time, and a lot of young, cool people were attracted to Scientology back in 68 and 69, you know? The Vietnam War was still on. You know, there were people, you know, people being murdered left, right, and center in the government that seemed to be on the correct side, you know? It was a mess.
That's true.
People really were looking for something, and there wasn't an awful lot there. You can't really see him all toddling off to the Torah. Sorry, Rabbi, but, you know, even my quarter Jew probably would have gone to Scientology.
Well, it's not the Torah. He could have put on Fiddler on the Roof, could have listened to the album. He felt better.
Yeah, it's true, actually. It would have cheered you up, wouldn't it? I mean, Jewish humor is very similar to British humor, and I think that's why Leonard Cohen was so loved and adored in Britain before he kind of caught on in the U.S. I mean, those first, earliest, darkest albums would get to the top of the charts, or number 2 in the charts, or number 3 in the charts, because we kind of thought it was funny as darkness, and he thought it was kind of funny when he wasn't, of course, thinking about slashing his wrists, you know?
Well, what pulled him out of depression? Was it just, did he find the right combination of drugs, or was it just a cloud that lifted, like that little pill on the animated cloud on TV? It suddenly drifts away.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, and one, of course, that I asked him. And he was, again, sort of slightly ambiguous in his answers. As he said, his mum said, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, it's gone. But mostly it was a kind of through discipline. One of the things that was very interesting about Leonard, and something that, you know, the sort of three-quarters of me that isn't Jewish doesn't associate with Jewish, is that he had a kind of very warlike, you know, sort of side to him. He wanted to go to military academy. His father had been one of the first officers to sign up and fight for Canada, you know, in the First World War. But he really had this kind of military thing and kept wanting to join armies. He wanted to join the Socialist Revolution, and Cuba actually went there. But, you know, he had this kind of side to him that kind of had this kind of wanted order and being told what to do. And so I think in the end it was mostly the study, 30 years at least of studying Buddhism for very long periods, including 5.5 years living on a hideous mountain monastery. I went up there for 2 days and escaped, you know, dug an escape tunnel with a spoon I stole, told him so. And then later from that, going to study core Hinduism. All of these being more, as you said, a kind of practice rather than a discipline more than anything else. And I think over the years that just calmed him down. And finally, he woke up one morning, looked out the window, saw sunlight sparkling off a car, he said, and he felt happy. And he thought, oh my God, is this what normal people feel like? It's gone, and he doesn't want to question it in case it comes back.
So the last time you were in touch with him, that's how he felt. He felt good.
Yeah, he was really happy. I mean, this was at the end of the process of writing the book. Having interviewed him as a music journalist, at one point, over a 3-day period, we did a really long piece for my English magazine that I write for called Mojo, which is known for very long pieces on people. You know, he just seemed so content now. You know, so much, even from, you know, over the years, it's just got sort of younger in his face. It's like somebody just lifted all the pain away and there's a sparkle in his eye.
I just don't get it. I mean, here's a guy who went around having fame, having acclaim, stooping Joni Mitchell, stooping almost everyone except Nico, and then he was unhappy. I don't, now he's old, his penis probably doesn't even work anymore. Oh, he's joyful. This I do not understand one bit. But
well, he's got this kind of disciplined life on the road. I saw him, as I was going to say, at the end of the process, I sort of rambled a bit, but one of the reasons why I spoke to him at the end of the process because is I know he's very good at sort of putting the wool over your eyes in an answer, so I wanted to speak to just about everybody that you ever knew that was important beforehand so that I could have the questions so tightly composed that he couldn't wriggle out of the answers. So it was a very kind of interesting time that we spent together. A very charming time. He's a lovely man.
Of course.
I saw him just after the first bit of the tour ended, the 2008-2010, finished in Las Vegas, and I saw him 2 months later, went to his house in L.A., really kind of simple, sweet little house, nothing on the wall, you know, no ornaments anywhere or anything, or platinum albums up or anything like that. And I saw that there was a little kind of sadness in his eye then. And I said, you miss it, don't you? And he knew exactly what I was talking about. He said, yes, I miss the road. And then he did a new album, went back out there, and I saw him backstage, I guess it was a few months ago, one of his shows, and he just looked like a 10-year-old. His eyes were bright, he was skipping around with his guitar on his back, you know, going back to the hotel. And so it's that kind of discipline of being out there, knowing what he has to do, almost like being in an army or being in the monastery, has given him this sort of sense of, I know, freedom as far as the depression is concerned.
Well, Sylvie Simmons, the author of I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen, you did that long interview with him for Mojo magazine. How did you make that leap then to saying, you know what, there's a book in this, a book that I'm going to spend, 3 to 5 years?
Oh, don't even remind me. I mean, I was in a little kind of padded cell for most of the time, other than the time when I was running around trying to go to everywhere that he'd ever been, you know, as far as living. And the man never stays still. He stays very still in his work. He keeps up the same themes and the same ideas, but, you know, he's always moving around as if he's trying to escape himself somehow. But yes, it was why I did it was at the time after that interview, when I came out like every other journalist does if they've spoken to Leonard Cohen, with a little blush in my cheeks and smoking an imaginary cigarette and thinking I have the best interview with him ever. And then you read it and you realize that he's managed to be truthful but not give you the whole truth. And so at that time I thought, you know, I'm going to read more about him. And I read the books and I still didn't feel that I knew him. So over time, eventually, you know, being a lazy so-and-so, you know, I didn't really want to spend all those years working on a book. But finally, when that tour started, I just thought, I really want to write a book that has diligence and heart and that has Leonard's character in this person, and, you know, as well as his kind of art and work in there. And that was what I tried to do, and I hope I managed.
Now, prior to the book, you had written about Neil Young. You wrote a book. How much access did you have to him?
Well, I've interviewed him so many times over the years, but that was a very different book. It was a kind of extended biographical essay that was part of a series that we were putting out at Mojo magazine. It was going to be kind of a book. We were going to have books on just about all of the great people that we totally admired and loved, like Neil Young. And in the end, we only did 4 books because being rock people, people, we somehow managed to fall out with the publishing people over some argument or other, Lord knows. So this wasn't written as this kind of super in-depth thing, but yes, I did have access to him, but not for the book. I didn't ask for it. I did it from interviews I'd done before. And Serge Gainsbourg's book, that book I wrote, was when, just after Serge had died, was when I kind of fell in love with him, which was a little bit kind of awkward, really. You know, necrophilia, not...
Well, yeah, that's a little sick. Yeah. And you go for Jewish men with long noses. Who knew?
Well, Canadians, it's funny. If I do a sort of Venn diagram for books I write, but, you know, it's a strange thing. It's mostly it's to do with a kind of obsession that borders on a kind of a love, in a way. You know, it's like I really, really, really kind of dig this person. I really want to find out lots about what makes them tick, why they're so special, because all of these people I've written about, they're one-offs. You know, you can't say, oh, that Neil Young, he sounds like somebody else, or his oeuvre is like anybody else.
Well, it sounds like a cat being strangled sometimes, but I love it. I love it.
My ex-husband said that. I think that was why I kind of made him an ex-husband.
Oh, well, we'll get into that, by the way. Do you have a new husband, or you're in the what?
Well, I'm still available, boys. You can see my pictures on my website.
Which is? Well, what is that website?
It's sylviesimmons.com, and it's kind of updated with my tour dates and also me singing Leonard Cohen, various videos that have happened along the way. Having outed Leonard as a ukulele player, I decided I would go on the road for a year with my ukulele and not just read but talk but sing his songs and pick up just musicians. I don't mean pick up musicians in that way, but pick up various musicians in each town and they would join in. So it was a wonderful process. Some amazing, amazing things came from it.
And are you putting out an album yourself?
Going to be putting out an EP of my songs, actually. I just, having been on the road for a year, people kept sort of asking me to, so I will do that at some point. You know, all music journalists, we're always accused of being wannabe rock stars, you know, and I guess it just took me a little longer than Chrissy Hynde and Patti Smith to get around to it.
So who influenced your kind of songs? What kind of music do you make? Is it indigenous to you, or who are you?
It's sad. I mean, basically, I like sad songs. Even as a little girl, I adored sad songs, and that's probably why I was so drawn to Leonard Cohen, you know, that just hearing that sort of mournful voice, and he seemed to be almost like the king of sad for a while, but then as I got older and I understood a little more what he was singing about, it, you know, I realized it wasn't sad. I mean, there's a lot of kind of dark humor in it.
So your next book is going to be about Morrissey, I guess.
Oh, my Lord, no. No, I have an allergy to Morrissey.
Most of it. Some of it is great. But so what, are you working on another book, or are you going to not write another book again?
You know, it's so funny. Right now, I've been writing really, really short stories. My last book before this one was a short story collection. But even those short stories felt too long. So I'm writing these kind of one-minute stories, i.e., they can be read in a minute. They take a little longer than a minute to write, I have to say. But just because the long form now is just is scary, you know, the idea of writing another book of that length, you know, 600 pages. And it was even longer before I cut it down to that. It was almost like, you know, Winston Churchill, the war years. You know, we could have had 15 volumes on him. So I had to kind of make it dance off the page a little so that people wouldn't throw themselves off of cliffs at the thought of reading all the way through it.
But you also, before you really started writing the book, you had a contract from HarperCollins. You didn't just do it on spec. You at least knew that someone would publish it and you had a real deal?
Yeah, what I did is I put in a proposal. You know, quite often writers, journalists, music journalists, are often approached by different publishers with the idea of writing a book. They say, will you write a book on Fill in the Gap, you know, Fleetwood Mac, or will you write a book about Morrissey? I think I'll shudder again. And so some people say yes. I've said no to those for the simple reason that you don't have control. I'm a control freak, at least when it comes to my work. And so, you know, I actually put in a proposal, and various publishers said yes or no. And HarperCollins in the US, rather Echo at HarperCollins, asked to be my publisher. And in the UK, Jonathan Cape, which is part of Random House, asked to be my publisher. So, and there was also in Canada, McLelland and Stewart, who published Leonard Cohen. So I had this kind of three-part harmony going on. Maybe not always quite as harmonious as it should have been, but there you go.
And during all this time that you're writing the book, you're also writing still articles for Mojo and other places, yes?
Not really. Oh. I did a few for Mojo because I'm their kind of person. I've been with them since the beginning. I'm their correspondent. And so I did stuff when I really, really, really couldn't get out of it. If it was something that was going on in my neighborhood that they couldn't get anybody else to do, or a person that wanted to talk to me and not anyone else. But mostly my life was led through Leonard Cohen. It's kind of a strange feeling when you dedicate that much time and thought and work to one person. It's kind of like you're stalking them, but inside your head, you know, you're living their life. And it was funny, at the end of the process, one of the things I said out of kind of exasperation to Leonard was, it's like, I said, it wore me out being you. And he kind of gave a little smile, and I said, oh, you're worrying about everything, and what was wrong with this woman for crying out loud, or this religion, you know? And he gave a little smile, and I patted my hand and said, yes, yes, I know, but I don't live in that reality anymore, darling. He calls all women darling.
Oh, well, yeah. And, and that's when your blush started, I'm sure.
Oh, he knows how to make me blush. He's so cheeky. I mean, he's got such a sense of humor. He's a, you know, you'd think that of him as a kind of, you know, the sort of godfather of gloom in some ways. But nowadays, I guess with the shows that he's doing, he's really showing his humor a lot, you know?
Well, let me ask you.
He's a stand-up comic.
I have to know, did he ever make a move on you? Come on.
No, as if I would, as I told Dave, I never kiss and tell. I think that, you know, Leonard Cohen is one of those people who is so charming and so adores women. He gives them so much focus. You know, it's like you're the only person on planet Earth when you're around him, whether you're asking him a question about, you know, his music or whatever it might be. So it can be very easily kind of interpreted as being an offer. And I'm sure he wouldn't refuse, you know, any kind of yeses that came his way. But, you know, I never felt uncomfortable around him.
Well,
there's some
rock
stars that you kind of meet where you just think, oh, put it away, for heaven's sake. You know, remember, I get the last word on this. Well, I've seen one of those before, but they're usually bigger.
Oh, my God.
There's all these lines that you can kind of, you know, you can use on them, and it sort of, it seems to work.
I mean, the one woman who did also resist his charms is a story in the book of Nico, who was part of the Velvet Underground, part of the Warhol crowd, discovered by Fellini. Why? What was her thing?
You know, nobody could really explain that, including her absolutely wonderful flatmate, you know, at the time who I spoke to, and he was saying that, but, you know, absolutely everybody loved Leonard, including her. I don't know, maybe it was just a good game for her in a way that, you know, there was this older guy that was really into her. On the other hand, she did have so many, you know, the choices she had were so great that probably Leonard Cohen would at that point have fallen a little further down the list because, you know, I mean, for heaven's sake, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, and Still My Beating Heart, an 18-year-old Jackson Brown, for heaven's sake. I mean, if a woman has those around her, it's going to be, you know, probably a little harder to go after Leonard.
And ultimately, she chose heroin, so there you go.
Well, strange. You know, it was a bit of a mess, but, you know, those are strange times, and she was part of that kind of, that Chelsea Hotel, New York scene where a lot of that was going on. It was much darker than the drugs that were going on at the same time on the West Coast, you know, where people were dropping acid and smoking dope and, you know, seeing God that way. It was all that sort of darker and stranger.
Can I ask you, Sylvie Simmons,
yes,
has Leonard Cohen read your book?
I have no idea. Dear, he was wonderful. He gave me his support, didn't ask for anything. I think the only thing that I remember kind of asking him specifically, because one of the publishers wasn't very happy with me referring to him as Leonard in the book. They thought it was undignified. And somehow it just didn't feel right to call him Cohen, partly because there were so many Cohens to talk to.
That's right, yes.
But also, it just didn't feel right. So I asked him, I said, oh, by the way, you know, would you rather be called Leonard or Cohen? And he said, what do you think, darling? And I said, well, you know, I've started calling you Leonard, but, you know, I can even swap it. Maybe when I'm talking about your work, I could switch to Cohen. And he said, I think Leonard's nicer.
Well, there you go.
But that was his only input. And he also had said at one point that he didn't want it whitewashed because there was another sort of incident I had where there was a slight difficulty with a publisher. And he just asked me about it, but I just shrugged and smiled. And he said, you know, do they want a hagiography? You know, a sort of book of the saints. And I just shrugged and he said, don't let them whitewash it.
Nice. This is.
And I thought that's, you know, he just trusted me to write what I write. And you know, we spoke quite a great deal at the end of the process before I finished the book. He was actually dancing everybody out of the book at the end. I said, I've come to, so you can talk everyone out of the book. And he decided to dance them out of the book instead, which is sweet. But as it, you know, he was an absolutely generous person throughout, you know, didn't ask for any changes. There probably are some things that he's not hugely comfortable with in the book, but when you look at it, examining somebody's life that closely, he comes out as a very decent man, especially for a celebrity. And, you know, they're known for their kind of egotism and narcissism and, you know, having sort of collateral damage along the way. But generally, he seems to be a very decent man.
Well, let me bring another almost decent man back on the radio.
Ah,
I've been monopolizing.
Really, really difficult rabbi questions. I was so pleased because, you know, being only a quarter, I'd probably get them wrong and then I'd incur the loss.
Well, I did hear you tell Dave that Leonard Cohen offered you a hot dog, a kosher hot dog at one point. But
I know, I did blush a little at that.
It was just a dog.
Kosher hot dog. But I turned it down, actually, because it was there was an alternative, which was scrambled eggs, and I've never tasted such good scrambled eggs in my life as Leonard makes. He does everything meticulously in the way that you would imagine. You know, he doesn't just get a frying pan out. It's almost like a Japanese tea ceremony when he makes scrambled eggs.
Okay, well, that's
the boost. It's a very slow, delicate process. And he serves it with a good glass of Margaux, you know, good French wine. So, what can you call
it? Oh, my God. When I make scrambled eggs, I throw the egg in there with the shell, it goes in the microwave, and I get a bottle of Yoo-Hoo. That's how I do it.
No, you see, I think if, you know, if I had to choose between you and Leonard, it might be a tough fight, but, you know, you probably wouldn't win. Sorry, Rabbi.
Story of my life.
Really hard question.
Well, let me bring Dave. Maybe Dave would win. Hold on, let me bring Dave. Dobin, come talk to Sylvie Simmons. I have more questions for her. Sylvie, hi, Dave.
Hey, Dave.
Oh, so I was just listening in the other room and the rabbi asked some great questions, but I want to also ask about some of the other folks that you talked to and that you've interviewed over the years for Mojo and these other magazines. So, because, I mean, obviously you're pushing the Leonard Cohen book for obvious reasons, but, I mean, when I see the list of folks that you have had access to and talked to, I mean, Frank Zappa, when he was alive. Certainly not after his death.
After his death, it was very inconvenient, our interview after he died. Yeah, it really didn't go well at all.
But what was it like talking to, and at what stage, when did you get to talk to Frank Zappa?
God, I think the first time must have been about 78 or 79, 19.
So the Joe's Garage
but
era.
I remember the first time I interviewed him, he was really nasty, and he just hated the English. And I just sort of, I think I got into a bit of an argument with him, but kind of sweetly, you know. But I think it was something to do with him falling off stage at the Hammersmith Odeon or somewhere in England and getting injured. So he had this real kind of chip on his shoulder and probably a broken leg.
Yeah.
Now, England.
He was really hurt in that incident, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and so, but then we spoke again. I think I just held my ground, and in the end, you just, you know, you can't really get too mad at some sweet little kids that's sitting there who knows your music. And so we kind of got along fairly well, and then at one point he invited me over to his house to hear some stuff he was doing in a studio. I think that was probably a year or two later. And that was great, getting to meet the wife and kids and just hearing how he worked there and his sort of experimental stuff he was working on. But he's a bit of a grump. You know, I remember he was grouchy, but I kind of like grouchy people.
Well, then let me ask you, and since we also talked about Nico and nasty people, the legendary one would be Lou Reed. Did you ever interview Lou Reed?
Yeah, they're actually on my website. I've put up the copy of the interview. I've just put a few of my interviews up there. But one of the ones I chose was one that I did with him from Mojo. Really, I mean, he and Van Morrison could have a kind of arm wrestling match. Who's the most miserable git in this planet Earth? He's just, he's impossible. But actually, during the interview, he was so impossible, I laughed. I mean, it just made me laugh, and I don't think that helped. I mean, he's just, what can I say? Very talented. I love his music. I'll still sit there listening to Perfect Day with tears in my eyes or Pale Blue Eyes or, you know, those songs that he wrote. And I adore Velvet Underground in every way, shape, and form. But as a human being, I don't know what his problem is. I mean, and he's got such a lovely wife, Laurie Anderson. I mean, she's great.
Well, but
so
again,
he must be nice. Maybe he just doesn't like being around journalists.
Well, at what point, I should also ask, at what point did you interview Lou Reed? I mean, was it in the last 15 years, or was it 25? Really? And he's still a dick.
Well, I mean, enough, he's just not nice. He's just like an angry little troll or something. You know, it's really quite weird, especially as when you get to interview people of that sort of status and with that sort of sense of control over what they do. All of these things are worked out a bit like the Middle East Peace Conference. You know, he gets sent articles I've written, and I remember he got sent my Ginsburg book, and, you know, it's whether I'm worthy of speaking to him. So it's not like, you know, you just pop in off the street with a tape recorder and chat. But I don't quite understand. I remember towards the end of the interview, or as it was kind of even before the end, I was saying to him that, you know, this is a Q&A piece, and you know that I'm just doing a small introduction, and I don't know about you, but I don't think we were kind of really doing too well. Would you rather we just did scrap this and start again, you know? Hmm. No, that's it. We're had enough. And so, you know, that was it.
And you mentioned also that you got to talk to Van Morrison, and he wasn't the most pleasant individual either.
Well, it's more, you know, the difficult people are difficult people. It's as simple as that. But, you know, funnily enough, though there are quite a few sort of narcissists and sort of weird people in the music business, the majority aren't. And even if they are a bit difficult, they've spent their life doing something that they're passionate about. And so there's always something that you get from talking to them, even though sometimes they're a little bit either crazy or a bit of a pain in the bum. They've spent their life doing something that they love and that I love. And so it's very easy to kind of put that to one side. But
well, what did you get?
You know, funnily enough, I'm sitting here. I've got the new copy of Mojo here with Johnny Cash on the cover. And that's my piece in there.
Right.
And that was probably at the other end of the scale, one of the most amazing things. I spent 5 days with him at his house in Hendersonville, the one that burned to the ground when Barry Gibbons of Bee Gees bought it after Johnny Cash died. And I spoke to him for a box set called Unearthed. We did a book for that. We were going to do another book. This was 6 weeks before he died.
Oh, my.
So I got to have breakfast every morning with Johnny Cash. I mean, those things are kind of amazing. I mean,
well, what was that like? In other words, did he have a sense of his own impending demise, and how did he deal with that?
No, it was a very, very strange time for him, because it was 6 weeks after June Carter, his wife, had died, and it was a very unexpected death. She'd gone into hospital for a routine operation, and he was the one who was going in and out of hospital and being on the verge of death every 10 minutes, with June organizing on the internet prayer of bonds worldwide for him. But June just suddenly died, and he was absolutely broken and lost, and his health was terrible. He was in a wheelchair. His eyes, he had glaucoma, he couldn't see very well.
Really?
His hands were shaking from this autonomic neuropathy disease that he had. He had diabetes. He was in a mess. He looked about 90-something when he was only 71 years old. But he was fighting, and he was fighting. He just thought that, you know, since God hadn't killed him, and he was very much a godly man, that he was meant to be doing something. So he was back recording.
He said,
if I'm going to get through this, I have to work. I have to work on songs. Hmm. And so he was seeing doctors pretty much every day, and physiotherapists while I was there. And every afternoon, pretty much, if he felt up for it, he would try and sing. Couldn't play guitar anymore because his hands shook too much. And so he was just working and working. And then we'd chat over breakfast, which was always at some ridiculous hour of morning.
Yeah. And you
could
make a passage, which is kind of...
I'd get up thinking, oh, my Lord, it's the middle of the night. That was an absolutely amazing experience. This is kind of my crazy life.
Yeah, no, and I would love also to hear that you interviewed Tom Waits.
Oh, I love Tom
Waits.
I think I might put one of the interviews with him on my website too. And last time I interviewed him, he gave me some homegrown heirloom tomatoes.
Oh.
I have never been given tomatoes by a rock star in my life up until that point.
Well, that's the thing. I wouldn't know whether to eat them or kind of... Well, you couldn't really frame them because they would only last like a week. But...
I know, but it's more of an art project that way, isn't it? You know, I'm sure I'd get money from the Tate Gallery in London to display rotting tomatoes or something. It's great modern art. Yeah, he's wonderful. He's a very shy man, and he likes to present a kind of Tom Waits in quotes. You know, that's his comfort zone.
Yeah.
But I think he's wonderful. I really, you know, really. really, really like.
But is he, in the way that Cullen is, but even more so, is he always cagey in interviews? Is it always a joke? Can you not trust half the things he said because he's making it up out of whole cloth just for fun?
Well, you know that he's presenting this character, and that's obviously got some of him in it. You know, if there's an actor playing a part, you've still got some of the actor in there. There is some of that, but he was very open on certain things, you know? And it was weird with Tom, you could kind of tell, because it's like when he was telling something that was really kind of frankly untreated truth, his hand would almost like go up to his face as if to cover his mouth so I wouldn't hear it sort of thing. It was very interesting body language on that. But I think that part of your job as a music journalist is to kind of uncover but also present. So you're presenting the character that they give you, but you're also occasionally uncovering, but not everything. It's not like, hey, I'm just going to out him and, you know,
right,
destroy the mystery.
I don't know if you were able to get to this, but how much is Kathleen Brennan, his wife,
yes,
is a collaborator on the song? How much is him and how much are we not really crediting is actually her on albums going all the way back to, you know, Alice and Mulebone and beyond them?
Well, she is credited. I mean, she just isn't the kind of human being that wants to jump up and say, hey, look at me, you know, it's her husband who's the brand, if you like, you
right.
know. But he's very open at saying what their collaboration was like. And I remember in one of the interviews, I'm not sure if it was the one I put up on my website, but I kind of said, like, what would a fly on the wall see if, you know, if they kind of happened to be in there when you and Kathleen were working together, you know, which, you know, and he was really funny. It was like sometimes blood and gore. She was the one with the sentimentality meter. He said if he got too sentimental and stuff, it's like she'd go crazy on that, or she'd sort of move it in different directions. And he said how much, you know, her musical taste and her musical record collection had been such a huge influence on him when they first started going out. So he's always been very open about that. It's just I don't think people tend to ask him a lot about that, because, you know, when you're doing an article, you know, you kind of have an idea of your audience and your magazine, and, you know, part of it is you're kind of giving them what they want, and they don't necessarily want to hear about his wife, even if she's his very close collaborator.
To me, that is interesting. To me, it's like, am I giving Lurie credit for writing X, Y, and Z when I should be crediting her for that lyric? Or although it is interesting for me to know that he's the sentimental and soppy one, and she's the one who's kind of tossing in Kommen Sie zu spät or something like that.
Yeah, but I think it's one of those things that, you know, if you've got a kind of a really good partnership with somebody, whether it's marital or whether it's business, there is a time when it becomes so sort of seamless that you don't know who's done what.
Mm.
I guess it was the same to some degree with, you know, with John Lennon and Paul McCartney, that there'd be songs that one of them came and started, you know, and you can usually tell it's because John sings the songs that he maybe started or instigated or, you know, did the main work on, and Paul would do his. But there'd be times when they would just be so seamless that without the other person's input, they wouldn't have turned out the way they had. So I'm sure there's a lot of that going on with those two, because it's a business partnership and a sort of social romantic partnership too. So I'm sure the whole thing just sort of slides together seamlessly.
Did you ever interview a Beatle?
Yes, I interviewed three different Beatles at different times, and the only Beatle that I didn't interview, and that's the one that breaks my heart because he was my first love. I don't mean this physically, I mean this emotionally, and that was John Lennon.
Well, I thought your first love was Leonard Cohen, because you said that you discovered his album the day you hit puberty.
Yeah, but my pre-pube love, which continued in the guy's solo career into my teen love, was John Lennon, because as a little girl in England, of course, I was Beatle damaged. You know, we were all Beatle damaged. We kind of, everything was filtered through Beatles and what the Beatles did and what they sang, and everything was Beatley. But I also got into other music, and one of those was the compilation album that I bought that had on it Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel and all these great Columbia artists, including Leonard Cohen. So once I heard him, I remember buying his first album with some, I think, my birthday money, because I didn't have any pocket money or anything, and being horrified at how old he looked on the cover. Oh my God, it could be my granddad. But there you go.
Well, but let's not move away from the Beatles so quick. What was it like interviewing George Harrison?
George, that was very early on in my career, and I think maybe my questions were a little bit too kind. Like, kept trying to get back to Beatles, and he was really kind of grumpy. I think it was the kind of George Harrison big cocaine years, you know, that he had. He wasn't in the So that wasn't so good. Paul I interviewed in London, I guess that must have been in the late 80s or something, and maybe early 90s, late 80s, I think. And he was very sweet and thumbs up and cheery, but you could tell that there was something a lot darker going on behind his eyes, you know, that he wasn't letting loose on. You could say there was some anger in there, I think. And Ringo I interviewed fairly recently in the last 5 years or so.
And Ringo is just Ringo.
Well, Ringo, but again, he could be tetchy.
Really?
You know, yeah. Hmm. He had that side to him that you had to be a little bit careful, but otherwise really articulate, looks very, very young for his age, you know, very wiry.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's a kind of strange thing, but John Lennon was the only one I never got, because I was hoping to interview him for Double Fantasy, and then, of course, well, I must have killed him.
Can I ask, and we're going to be wrapping up our wonderful interview here, me and the rabbi, with Sylvie Simmons, the author of I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen. But can I ask, I brought up some people that you've interviewed. Were there a couple of others that were just your favorite interviews ever, or that you were just so amazed that you ever got to talk to? Or any great stories of people that you got to talk to?
Well, so the ones that kind of stick in your mind are the kind of either they're completely outrageous and wild, or that you went on the road with them. I think going on the road with The Clash was kind of interesting.
Wow.
That was a fun one to do. But, you know, it's hard to say, because it's just my life has been non-stop talking to people. So as soon as I hang up, I'll think like, oh my God, I should have told you that one. But right now my head is, you know, mostly full of Leonard Cohen still. But
of course, yeah.
Oh, but it's more a case of your name. Oh, actually, probably, here's a good one then. Here's a good one.
Oh, yeah.
This is a good one. Michael Jackson.
Oh my goodness, okay.
Yes, and this was, I actually interviewed him 3 times. And the first time I interviewed him...
The first time you interviewed him, he was black. Which is kind of interesting.
He was definitely darker and wider of nose when I first interviewed him. And I was interviewing him with his brothers. They got the Jackson 5 together. I think they were just the Jacksons at that point. And it was in the family compound, the family house out in Encino in the valley. And his dad, the famous dad that, you know, doesn't get very good publicity. I kind of met the dad, and I could see why he doesn't get very good publicity. He's not the most pleasant man I ever met. And so I went in and interviewed them, and it was a very awkward interview. They were being uncooperative and a bit kind of sort of like coming up with, I don't know, sort of either scatological or sexual kind of answers. And but Michael wasn't. He was all sitting quietly. And when it was done, he came up to me and said, like, I think he could feel that I was suffering, and he was a guy who knew about suffering. So he said, would you like to see my studio? And he said, like, would you like to see my studio? This little voice. And I said, yes, please. And he took me to this little studio in the family house, and he was working on his first solo album there.
Wow.
And so he'd play me some cuts on that. And then fast forward, I guess, when that album came out, I did an interview at the home that he was renting when he'd moved out of the family house. And that was very curious, too. And Janet was there, kind of basically translating my questions from English to American every now and then. I think just to give him more time to think about the answers. But it was a very sweet and in-depth interview. And, and later, the last time I saw him was on the set of Beat It, when he was doing a video for that. And so we chatted a bit there.
And was he still, well, you got him in that situation, a sweet kid. Even then, at that point, he was a superstar.
He was a very sweet kid, especially at the interview at his house. And the last time that we spoke on the set of Beat It, he was adorable, but he said like he couldn't do a proper sit-down interview with me because he kind of had stopped doing interviews. I think he'd been stopped from doing interviews. He said because everybody was twisting everything he said and making him look like a monster. And he was like very apologetic and saying that, you know, just if you could maybe fax me some questions, I'll answer them, but I can't really do interviews anymore. And
but he didn't show you the Elephant Man or the Chamber or you know, a young boy under his mattress or anything like that.
But, you know, what's curious, that second interview I did with him at his rented house, I'd asked him that question, not that question specifically, but he had this kid. I seem to remember the name was Jordan, but I may be wrong. A little kid used to be on the road with him. I saw him, I went to some shows, and this kid would be hanging out, you know.
Yeah.
I'd just say to him, you know what? And the kid I remember was a bit bratty. And I'd said to him about the kissing, and he said, I can't remember the exact words, but it was something like, you know, I don't really have many friends, that kind of. My friends are Freddie Mercury and Diana Ross and Elizabeth Taylor. And I knew that a bit later he fell out with Freddie Mercury for some reason. And he said, but kids, he said, they kind of, they just love me for me, they don't care who I am. And I kind of said, well, of course they do. I mean, they like to hang with you because you're Michael Jackson, for heaven's sake. And he said, no, no. And he looked really hurt. It's like, no, no, you know. But he was talking a lot in our interview about his childhood. And it seemed like his childhood, even though he didn't say, like, I had a damaged childhood, sounded like it was so lacking in anything a childhood should have, that maybe he was just reliving his childhood, hanging with kids. It didn't seem to be anything predatory going on that I saw, and I'm sure I would have picked up on it. You know, it just was, he liked being around kids.
I mean, it is.
Whether it got twisted in later years, I can't say. I never spoke to him then, and never saw him then. But you know, certainly at that time, it seemed as innocent as it comes.
Well, for all we know, Michael Jackson hit puberty when he was 35. So up until then, you know, he was weird, and he liked having a childlike relationship, and then after that, suddenly, you know, something sprouts, and he's like, oh, kids can be fun in a different way. I don't know.
He said they didn't want anything from him, but I think, you imagine, you know, from what he was saying, his father was always pushing him for things. He said that I was asking him about his childhood, and kind of, you know, random questions, like, did you play sports, or what? He said, you know, I couldn't, because if I'd, like, my dad would say if I broke my wrist or something, you know, then the tour would be over and the family would be ruined. And, you know, it was kind of all the pressure was put on him as this child star. And he said, but that's okay, because I kind of got to go and see Buckingham Palace and meet. You know, he was coming up with the things that he did do as a kid, but all of it was so kind of weird. It wasn't like kiddie stuff.
It was couched in trying to make himself feel better about not really having a real childhood.
Kind of, and yeah. I just think that possibly was it, that it was a sort of arrested development in a way, and that, you know, he was very childlike. He was very gentle and very sweet the whole time that I was around him. There was just something about him. He gave off this sort of innocence and childlike, you know, it seemed like people were using him rather than him using other people. But as I say, over time, you know, I've always had the sort of theory of celebrity corrupting and corrupting absolutely. And my last book of fiction was Two Weird for Ziggy, was kind of based around that idea, you know, what celebrity does. To me, he seemed like a really sweet, innocent guy. What happened later when people kept giving him their children to play with, I don't know.
Oh, and last question, you know, I also wanted to mention the person that you have on your website who sounds really interesting to me, is that you got to interview Beck.
Oh, yeah, I don't know why I put that one up. I think I must have just liked that. Yeah, that was interesting because he's a Scientologist, but he is an avid Scientologist, you know, completely believes in it all. And I know that was one of the things that he didn't tend to speak about and why he would, you know, get into this kind of thing. And I know that the magazine really wanted me to find that out. And I think it was curious as well, because I'd interviewed him for my Serge Gainsbourg book. He's a huge fan of Serge Gainsbourg and has used some of his arrangements in his own songs and admitted to that. So I was just trying to find out a little bit more about this mysterious guy. He is fairly strange.
Right.
I liked him. Very likable.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah. Like, he seemed on this real trajectory and then kind of crashed into religion and has been sort of hiding there for a couple of years until, I guess, really recently, where he's working on new stuff now.
Yeah, he was often working on things behind the scenes, though. I think he just got sick of the big music business thing, and it's very easy to get sick of. Yeah. I mean, there are some people in the business that you really wouldn't want to have to deal with on a daily basis if you could help it, and I guess it's made him enough money not to have to.
Hey, speaking of which, and let's close out this wonderful interview with Sylvie Simmons it kind of brings together everything that we've been talking about.
This is the all-encompassing question.
Yes.
Fate.
Jewishness here?
Is it a yes, no answer?
No, it'd be Jewish, so it would be, you would answer the question with a question. That's the way to do it.
Ah, perfect. I manage that. Remember, I'm only a quarter Jewish, so it would be a quarter question.
Did you ever interview... now his name has escaped my head, but it was also involved with Leonard Cohen. Phil Spector.
It's a difficult question, then, because if I don't know who I'm answering, did I ever interview the mystery person?
No, Phil Spector.
Phil Spector. Phil Spector. I tried everything. He's the one still living producer that worked with Leonard that I didn't interview. That chapter, I have interviewed so many other people who are in the studio about it, but I sent questions to Phil, you know, because he's in jail, you know, for murder and serving a very long sentence. I sent him questions in advance so he knew what it was. I sent stamp addressed envelopes, several, And then I went through various friends of friends of friends, you know, which in this business we all have contacts who might be able to get questions to him, and tried. But in the end, it was difficult because the album that Leonard Cohen and Phil Spector made together, Death of a Ladies' Man, was a very curious album, and there were guns, at least not, if not used, then certainly waved around the studio in the making of the album. And so it's, at this point, as he's been now convicted of shooting somebody to death, if he's looking to do an appeal, he probably didn't want to get involved in talking about...
about waving guns around in a studio, yeah, that would be...
Yeah, because, I mean, the questions weren't about that. They were, you know, on a very different subject, but they were still about, you know, a chapter which does include guns, so, I mean, that's all in the chapter.
And it's not as if Ronnie Spector's going to be running to his defense either.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, but, you know, it's another one of those troubled geniuses who was probably given a bit too much power, and nobody really said stop doing that, you know, and that happens so much in the business when people become such big celebrities. They surround themselves with the wrong kind of advisors who don't say, put that gun away. They just smile and laugh. And eventually, if you have a gun's out too often, somebody's quite possibly going to get shot. And, you know, that poor woman was the one who got shot by Phil Spector, allegedly.
Allegedly.
We still don't know. There may be a different sort of outcome from the case if he does go to appeal.
Well, it has been tremendously appealing to... Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
That was quite possibly dreadful.
I was looking for the out, you know, something that you were saying in those last sentences to do the outro, and I just, that was what I went with. I apologize terribly to...
It was a real trial.
Thank you. To Sylvie Simmons, the author of I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen, which is published by HarperCollins. You can also read some of her wonderful older interviews with the people we've been talking about, people like Frank Zappa, Johnny Cash, Marianne Faithfull, Beck, Lou Reed, all the stuff. Plus, she's written works of fiction, and she is putting together a record album. All of this stuff, go to her website, sylviesimmons.com, S-Y-L-V-I-E, Simmons, with two M's, sylviesimmons.com, and check all that stuff out. And, of course, get her book on Leonard Cohen. She's also written books on Serge Gainsbourg. We didn't even have time to talk about him, and about Neil Young, too. Prolific and very fine writer, and very, very grateful to have had her in the neighborhood this morning on Dave's Gone By. Sylvie, just thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, too. I'd love to come back to the neighborhood one other day soon.
That would be great.
All right. Bye. And bye to the rabbi.